Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hello, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Wednesday, October 6th. I'm Jessica Steinberg. With me today are Startup Israel editor Ricky Ben-David and Arab Affairs correspondent Aaron Boxerman. Hello to you both.
Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Jessica.
Good to have you here. Ricky, we're going to get started today with you. You have an investigative report leading the site right now about housing prices in Israel, which have nearly doubled. And of course, you point to this idea of how is Israel's beleaguered middle class supposed to survive? And as I was thinking, this was the land where parents bought starter apartments for their kids. But so can they do that anymore? Much less can the kids buy apartments for themselves at any point. Tell us what you found. Tell us what it's all about.
So housing prices have been out of reach for a whole section of the population for a while now. Yes, you know, they've doubled in a decade, but this is a topic. This is a headline we've seen for about a decade now. There's not much that has changed. In fact, it's gotten worse. 10 years ago, we had these mass protests, including about the cost of living and also housing. Housing was a big issue, and it still is. And 10 years later, we're in a worse off situation in terms of the prices are keep going up. The researchers I cite in the piece say that it's really just going to get worse. There's not going to be, a solution unless the government actually takes action. And there's just different solutions, you know, being kind of thought about that exist all over the world. One of the researchers said, you know, this isn't rocket science. It's not a mystery. It's not a natural disaster. It is a human-made situation that can be fixed. There are solutions can be offered for people, whether it's social housing, whether it's lowering taxes required. The main issue really is the supply. The supply very much is restricted, and there's demand, and we have a growing population, and it really is going to get so much worse, and more people are going to be priced out. They're at the whims of landlords who rent it out. In Israel, a lot of the contracts are annual. There's options, you know, for extending, but you know the average contract is for 1 or 2 years. It's not a long-term solution. It puts people in a situation where they are financially insecure, where they have to move every few years. It is an untenable situation for so many people.
Ricky, is it worse in the bigger cities? Is it terrible everywhere? How does it compare in that sense?
So, of course, in the high demand cities of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and generally in central Israel. So in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, of course, the prices are sky high, and they've been for a long time now. But even for people, you know, who want to live in the suburbs, who want to live in like Bat Yam, Ramat Gan, Rehovot, these places, the prices, you know, the study shows in the piece that I cite, the study shows that the average four-room that's a three-bedroom apartment in Israel is, over 2 million shekels, which is in dollars. It's a crazy amount. Even it's almost $700,000 for an apartment. Yeah.
Right.
So in if in North American terms, we're all thinking like, wow, that's, you know, for that price, you buy a house. Maybe not in San Francisco, maybe not in New York, but you can buy a house.
Right. A real house with a yard.
Price. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'm also curious in terms of the story, is it a very different story for rental versus purchase market, or is it essentially a similar story?
So that is going to be a follow-up that I'm going to do, explore the rental market. But the rental market has also gone up, not as high, and arguments can be made that, you know, rental prices in Israel are relatively low compared to other capitals, you know, New York, London, Paris. But still, for so many people who have to, you know, negotiate these contracts, and again, they're annual or you know, for 2 years, some people, especially in you know, high demand areas like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And so it becomes a situation where people just feel the frustration. They feel tired. They're kind of problem solving from year to year, and there's no long-term solution for them. The protests, you know, I wrote about a protest that happened on Saturday. It was very small, but here we are 10 years later with another protest. And admittedly, you know, Daphne Leaf started 10 years ago with just a tent, and it grew. So there's no saying where it will go, but right. It's honestly just very sad.
What about the Israeli culture of parents buying their kids apartments, which was, you know, a couple would get married and the parents or the two sets of parents would buy their kids an apartment. Is that a concept anymore? Or is there anyone who can afford to do that anymore, except for the richest people in Israel?
It's extremely widespread in Israel. I know
still.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the way Israelis, you know, young-ish Israelis buy apartments. They have help from their parents. They have significant help from their parents. You know, the study showed that you need an average of something like $260,000 nowadays to start. That is astronomical. That is, you know, unachievable, even with years and years of saving.
Right.
I cite someone who saved for 7 years to buy an apartment for her family, and she too needed, you know, a big boost from her in-laws. So it's right. very widespread, and this is a common way that a lot of Israelis buy apartments. But for many, you know, the parents don't have, or the parents have many kids. Can they come up with, you know, at least like $500,000 shekels for each child?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's
exactly.
It's
no, I have nieces and nephews who are moving from the center to the north because that's the mm-hmm. only way they can afford to buy. Right.
Right. So that is one of the, you know, solutions that people are taking. They're buying in places that they don't necessarily want to live, where, you know, away from their families, away from the communities in which they grew up. And Israel is very family centric, right? Like people see their families all the time.
Right.
So
you want your grandparents nearby. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. This is the way a lot of families take care of the kids, with grandparents involved and relatives and so on. So they have to move to places that are underdeveloped and that face, you know, transportation issues. And it is one of the solutions, but it just becomes, you know, a situation where they're just moving away from their families, and it's not what they want. You know, people want to live closer to where they grew up, to where they have a community.
Right. Makes sense. Okay. I'm very excited to read your follow-up piece as well. Excited might be the wrong word, but certainly curious and interested.
Right. This Times of Israel podcast is brought to you by Koren Publishers Jerusalem. Whether you're looking to enrich your mind or your soul, Koren Publishers has it all. From Israeli history to the works of Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Steinsaltz, and other contemporary thinkers, including the brand new Magamon edition Koren Tanakh, with translation by Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, Jessica Sacks, and many others. Times of Israel listeners can get 10% off your entire order. Just go to korenpub.com and use the code TOIPOD, that's KORENPUB.com, and enter the code TOIPOD for your 10% discount.
All right, Aaron, to a very different topic. You've written very extensively over the last couple of days about the government decision to step up Shin Bet involvement in fighting organized crime in Arab communities. We actually spoke about this with Manny yesterday as well. And we really wanted to hear from you today about what are Arab Israelis thinking and saying about this? What are their thoughts about it? Shin Bet means one thing in the Arab community. And I don't think it's about fighting organized crime. So we'd love to hear your thoughts about this.
Well, I think it's definitely an enormously, enormously sensitive and controversial issue. On the one hand, we see that the level of violence and organized crime, it's the number one priority for Arab Israelis. It feels, you know, somebody told me during an interview, like every day we're waking up to new reports of murders and shootings and extortion. And the degree of personal insecurity that Arab Israelis feel is enormous. And there's a reason why, you know, every Arab Israeli party ran on eradicating organized crime during the last election. And, you know, these sort of desperate times have led some to seek very, very desperate solutions. But for Arab Israelis, involving the Shin Bet is enormously complicated, to say the least, to say the very least. First of all, you know, the Shin Bet, it's a security agency. It's best known for targeting Palestinian terror groups in the West Bank. But it also is very, very active in, you know, in terms of monitoring Arab Israelis as well. You know, it's not a secret that, for example, the Shin Bet has agents who monitor incitement in Arab-Israeli communities that seek to, you know, investigate what's going on in Arab-Israeli cities in terms of terrorism. I spoke to a former Shin Bet official who essentially said, wherever there are Arabs, to quote him, the Shin Bet is there. And that sense of being viewed as a security threat is something that Arab Israelis are very familiar with. And it's one of their key complaints about how the whole issue of violence and organized crime is being dealt with. Arab Israelis commonly say the Israeli government views us not as citizens, not as equal citizens, but rather as just another security threat or potential terrorist. And that the decision to bring the Shin Bet into fighting organized crime is just another part of that. For example, one Arab mayor who I spoke with, you know, pointed to the history of eradicating organized crime in Jewish cities. In the early 2000s, there were Jewish crime syndicates that were very involved in Nahariya and in Ashdod that were quite powerful. You know, they were assassinating one another in broad daylight. I mean, there was really quite a sense of deep insecurity that existed in quite a bit of Jewish Israel. And the police and the state, the attorney general and the tax authority did these very complicated investigations, and they essentially uprooted the organized crime groups without turning to this joker, as one police officer called it, you know, the sort of idea, this wild card that could be thrown into the mix. And so one Arab mayor who I spoke with said they didn't need the Shin Bet when they eradicated crime groups in Nahariya and in Ashdod. Why do they need this now? Just because we're Arab Israelis, right? And we exist in this strange space where we're not viewed 100% as citizens because of our ties, because many of us identify as Palestinian and so on. On the other hand, some Arab Israelis do undoubtedly, it's hard to know how many, it could be a small minority, but they do exist. People that are simply desperate for any kind of solution to the violence. I spoke with one mayor, the mayor of Rahat, who essentially said, let the Shin Bet in, let the devil in. I don't care.
Just get rid of it.
It's unbearable. One longtime anti-violence activist whose son actually was gunned down in 2009, I believe, and by unknown gunmen, the police have, you know, over the last 12 years have not found who did it. He said, you know, I don't oppose any, you know, the intervention of any agency. You know, when I asked him specifically about the Shin Bet, as long as there's no return to some kind of military rule or, you know, our lives become controlled by this agency. So I think, you know, even supporters of this kind of measure understand that there's a very fine line to be walked, right? You know, like on the one hand, we understand that the Shin Bet is very powerful. You know, it has a lot of legal and intelligence tools that could threaten civil liberties, and it would need to be handled with care. And you also have a lot of Arab Israelis who see it as, you know, absolutely unthinkable and unconscionable that, you know, that this kind of agency could be involved in policing or in investigating civilians for criminal activity.
Aaron, you mentioned Rahat, which of course is the largest Bedouin city in the south, in all of Israel.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if there's a difference between the more middle-class Arab-Israeli towns and cities and a place like Rahat, which definitely has a reputation of being a little bit of the Wild West in any case. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, is there a difference in reactions depending on the town, the village, the city, where it's located, and what their reaction is to this kind of interference from the Shin Bet on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, there's an enormous diversity of views, obviously. The National Council of Arab Mayors as a whole, if you ask them in general, their stance is essentially no. Like, we oppose this intervention, we're civilians, the police should deal with us, not the Shin Bet. So when you see scattered signs of support for this, I know that, you know, Rahat has seen some very, very nasty violence over the last year. And it could be the case that they would look on that more favorably there. But again, when it comes to the overall stance, I think it's important to be pretty clear that on the political level, Arab Israeli leaders have been quite clear that they don't support this kind of measure.
That's a pretty complex issue. Okay. We'll keep on following it, obviously, through what you're writing. I thank you both for being here today on this Wednesday morning in October.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you. Follow the Daily Briefing wherever you find your podcasts. We'll be back tomorrow.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from The Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Thanks for listening to The Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, on thetimesofisrael.com.